Hey, this is Jen Johans at FilmIntuition.com and Film Intuition on social media and Letterboxd. And this is Watch with Jen. Welcome to one of two Halloween episodes for this season of Watch with Jen. It's interesting, this summer when I was thinking about fall topics, because in the past we had some really good ones like Indiana sports movies for the fall, where we talked about, you know, Hoosiers and Rudy, because they seem to coincide with the season. I was thinking about cooler weather, gray skies, sweaters, and just thinking, you know, it's a Stephen King kind of time of year. Of course, Halloween is the culprit, and you think of spooky season and everyone getting ready for their Halloween parties and costumes and candy and pumpkin spice. But I was just thinking it would be amazing to do an episode on the universe of Stephen King, who is definitely one of the most prolific writers of all time, the most banned author of our day. His work constantly is being challenged in schools. Stephen King has written nonfiction, fiction, and there are so many incredible and some not so great adaptations of his work. So I was excited. I pitched it to my friends, and the first two who immediately jumped on board are the amazing guests you're going to hear today in authors William Boyle and S.A. Cosby. But I'll get to them in just a minute. It was kind of Stephen King's season. I didn't really plan that. I didn't think about the fact that The Long Walk was coming out in mid-September. If you haven't seen the film, it's very good, but it's very heavy. I have a story about that. I actually saw the movie on a first date. I know. The nicest guy. And we were going to originally go to see 2001 A Space Odyssey, which was at night. They were doing a huge presentation of it and it sounded wonderful. He had never seen the film, but it's also super long and it was starting kind of late and we were a little beat. So I was looking down, you know, at the movies that were playing, and I knew that this was supposed to be good. I didn't even like put it together how dour it was going to be. I'm like, oh, let's go to The Long Walk. Well, we went to The Long Walk. It was, you know, it's a great film, heavy as hell. It's definitely not first date bait, but, you know, he was a total sweetheart, so I want to give a shout out to him. He knows who he is. Thank you so much for taking me on an unusual first date, but, you know, we made it. Also, around the same time, at Poison Pen, we were sent a standee of Stephen King for his new book and something where he talks about banned books and censorship. And so we've been taking photos of people with a standee. We've been putting a raven on it, a witch hat, all kinds of things. So at my work, we have a huge Stephen King table and section. So I've just kind of been inundated by Stephen King this season. And it was a lot of fun to dig into some of these movies, check out a few that I had missed altogether, and talk about them and his entire oeuvre, really, with two authors who know his work incredibly well, including one who just contributed to The End of the World as We Know It, New Tales of Stephen King's The Stand. S.A. Cosby contributed to that. It has some incredible authors, Meg Gardner, Gabino Iglesias, C. Robert Cargill, Nat Cassidy, Richard Chismar. The list goes on and on. So that is available now. Alex Segura, Brian Smith, Paul Tremblay. You're going to want to pick that up for sure. But today's discussion was kind of a quick one. Sean Cosby is super busy and he's always so gracious and generous with his time, but he was running a quick errand. So he kind of hops in a little bit into the conversation. So it will kick off with my buddy William Boyle, who might be one of the guests you've heard the most on this podcast, and he's definitely one of the listener's favorites. So author William Boyle wrote 8 books set in the southern Brooklyn neighborhood where he was born and raised, including his debut, Gravesend, the story collection Death Don't Have No Mercy, The Lonely Witness, nominated for the Hammett Prize, A Friend is a Gift You Give Yourself, which was an Amazon Best Book of 2019. City of Margins, a Washington Post Best Thriller and Mystery Book of 2020. And Shoot the Moonlight Out, listed by Crime Reads as one of the 10 best noir novels of 2021. He lives in Oxford, Mississippi, and Bill's latest book is Saint of the Narrow Street. And you can actually see me interview on behalf of Poison Pen Bookstore alongside my intrepid coworker, Patrick Milliken. That video is available on the Poison Pen Bookstore channel on YouTube, so you might want to check that out. Of course, S.A. Cosby is a New York Times bestselling writer from southeastern Virginia. He is the author of All the Sinners Bleed, which was on more than 40 best of the year lists, including Barack Obama's, as well as Edgar Award finalist Razorblade Tears, and Los Angeles Times Book Prize winner Blacktop Wasteland. His latest novel is King of Ashes, and he has also won the Anthony Award, ITW Thriller Award, Barry Award, Macavity Award, BCALA Award, and Audie Award, and has been longlisted for the ALA Andrew Carnegie Medal for Excellence. And I'm so lucky to have them both as friends and share their thoughts with you. Thank you, guys. First up, we have William Boyle. Bill, how are you doing?
I'm good, thanks, Jen. How are you doing?
I am doing well. So Stephen King, was that an early favorite author for you, or how did you first get introduced to Stephen King's world?
Yeah, he was definitely an early favorite for me. I don't really remember the chronology of it, but I didn't grow up with my dad. He left when I was young, but I went to visit him on weekends, and my dad was a reader. And so he had, a lot of writers that I first got into was because my dad had those books around, and I would take them from him basically. Probably the two writers I first remember reading and really liking were Ed McBain and Stephen King. I was just kind of, I probably got something of Stephen King's from my dad. I remember reading The Eyes of the Dragon pretty early, and then I don't know. From there, I just kind of, it was very much in the air. All those in the 80s, all of his books were being made into movies, and I was reading whatever I could. So I read a lot of Stephen King pretty early. I remember reading It when I was like 11 or
Oh,
12.
wow.
And just kind of having it with me at school, kind of open on my desk under my textbook or whatever, and read it throughout the day. So yeah, he was one of my early favorites for sure. And I remember reading a lot about him. I remember my mom and stepdad and I took like a road trip to we wound up going to Nova Scotia, but we kind of went out of our way a little bit to go to Bangor just to kind of drive by his house so I could see it. So yeah, I loved him. I loved him from an early age, and I've read him kind of on and off throughout my life. I'll go back to him here and there, and
Yeah.
certainly I feel like I'm always kind of watching films and shows based on his works.
Yeah, I think for me, we're similar ages, so we both remember when all of these movies started coming out. The first one for me, my mom remembers working in the library, and the most popular author that she was seeing fly across the desk was Stephen King. And so she wanted to read one and make sure it was okay for me because, like you, I was a voracious reader, read a lot early when I was young. And the one I started with was Christine. I think it was maybe sixth grade, fifth, sixth, seventh grade, around there. And I loved the book. I loved the movie. And then I think I went with Firestarter because it was the Drew Barrymore
Yeah.
movie, and I loved Drew, and just went from there. I read even some more of his dramas. Like, I do remember sitting and reading Dolores Claiborne and reading some of his short stories, especially because I loved Stand By Me, which was probably the first Stephen King movie I ever saw without realizing it was Stephen King and The Body. I just kind of blew somebody's mind recently at the bookstore. It was like a kid who looked maybe 18 or so, and he was getting a special printing of it, and it was called The Body. And I was like, yeah, this is Stand By. He didn't put that together. And I was like, wait, are you serious? Yes. And so that was kind of cool. But
that
yeah, I think I've always loved his stuff, but like you, I've forgotten over the years, or I will go back to him. There's so much to read. I loved Stephen King on writing. That might be one of my favorite things he's ever written. I bought it for so many people. Yeah.
I love that book too, and I'm always find myself kind of drawn back into him, and I think I've gotten to see him, as a writer, especially just kind of through all these different lenses over the years. There was that kind of early exposure to him, and then it was like, once I discovered Jim Thompson and I realized Stephen King loved Jim Thompson, that kind of, changed my perception of Stephen King a little bit. And I started reading Richard Matheson, and I realized,
Yeah.
Stephen King, oh, Stephen King idolizes Richard Matheson, and that kind of, opened things up for me a little bit more too. So, yeah, and I've loved him as I love that On Writing book, and I love him as, somebody who always seems to be writing and talking about art that he loves, and, books and music and movies. So that's been a big thing for me.
Yeah, I think it's so cool too that he had so much encouragement from a young age. Like, he tells stories, I mean, he loved movies and reading, but that he would like copy images from comics and, and his mom would say something at like age 5 or 6, like, I bet you could do better. Or, kind of like make him change the stories. His aunt would give him a quarter for every story that he finished writing. And he would read so much. He tells a story about going to the bookmobile person and asking, what's a story about how kids really are? Because, instead of the goody goody, he was reading everything from like Nancy Drew to classics. But, then the bookmobile person handed him Lord of the Flies, and he said that really unlocked something for him. Like, this is what books could do. But one thing I love about King is, and he talks about this in On Writing, he said, as much as he loves music and he writes to music and he plays music, he said, you have to ask yourself when you're commuting, like, do you want to hear the same song for the 5,000th time, or do you want to hear an audiobook? Like, he's always filling his mind with creative ideas, which I think is very cool. Yeah.
Absolutely. Definitely been, a model for me too, just kind of like that way of loving stuff and always kind of engaging with, something, book, album, movie.
Yeah. I love that he isn't snobby about it, and how he seeks inspiration in places you wouldn't necessarily expect, like William Carlos Williams, he said, for the way he describes things. And I think his descriptions are one thing that he's really famous for. I also love how much he writes about writers. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah, and I was thinking, I've in preparation for this, I've rewatched a bunch of stuff and watched some other stuff for the first time, and like we were talking about, there's just so much stuff that, like there's never a shortage of stuff to catch up on with him. But one of the things that I've noticed is, and one of the things I really love about him and really respond to in general with any artist is the way he kind of hits the same things over and over, is always exploring, the same obsessions, the same things show up in various ways in different works, and certain works are riffs on things he's been riffing on throughout his career. So I love that sort of stuff, and watching everything, and rereading some stuff kind of in this compressed time frame really kind of, just made that clearer than ever.
Yeah, it really magnified it for me. I watched a bunch of these in a row, and it's like, oh, religion is popping up again. Like that's going to be a villain or something. Silver Bullet was a first watch for me. We will get into that later and stuff. But I also rewatched like The Mist, which I remember being so powerful. My story with The Mist is I was blown away by the film, and I mean it's really well done. It has this devastating ending. And I remember I got a call from my brother and he's like, "Oh, was it good?" I'm like, "Yeah, it was good." He went home on a Saturday night and rented it to show his wife. And at the end, he called me up and I hear in the background, "Who told you that was good, Jim?" And he said, "My sister." Well, she could go fuck herself because she was so upset about the ending and deservedly so. And I'm like, Jim, you don't show that to your wife who loves like rom-coms and stuff. And you guys just had a little kid. Like, no.
Yeah, that's such a good one. I didn't rewatch that right now, but I watched that not that long ago. Maybe right after Andre Brouwer died. I can't
Oh,
remember
yeah.
when I
Oh,
rewatched.
he's really good in that.
So good in it. And that was an early, I remember I had a audio cassette like before, this was in whatever the late 80s, early 90s, before like I would have never had listened to an audiobook at that point. I don't even know audiobooks really existed. I guess they did on cassette, but I didn't have them at that point when I was a kid. But I had an audio cassette of The Mist that was like an old time kind of radio show presentation of it
Oh, cool.
that I loved. I still have that cassette somewhere around here. And so that was definitely one I loved early
Yeah.
on.
Yeah, I
It took me a
remember.
while to get to that movie, for some reason, but when I did, I loved it.
Yeah, it kind of like fell through the cracks. I think it was an independent or it was for a studio that wasn't very popular, or maybe it was just the way it was released, but it did fall through the cracks. So it was kind of a word of mouth one. Incredibly disturbing, but it's Darabont. It's very well done. I guess there's an edition where it's black and white, which I kind of think might work better. I haven't seen it, but I've seen some clips of it in black and white, and I find that really interesting.
Yeah,
I know some stuff was changed. I don't know what because I haven't read that one, but.
I don't even. That was a. Was that in a collection, that story? I can't
Yes, I
remember.
think so.
Can't remember where that was originally.
Yeah.
I definitely remember like listening to that tape I had first, not reading it. But yeah, that's a great one. Definitely one of the more underrated ones, I think.
Yeah, I was asking everybody for their favorites and stuff and things they liked, and I was getting so many different answers,
There's so
which
much,
really
yeah.
shows everybody has a different connection, a different gateway. He has talked about how The Stand is the one that his longtime readers still gravitate to, or will talk about The Stand, but he didn't think he really found his rhythm until The Dead Zone. Then he said then that kind of unlocked everything for him.
It's
So
been so
there's
long since I've read some of this stuff and even watched some of these movies. Like last night I watched Firestarter, which I hadn't seen, and
I haven't seen since childhood. What did you think?
it scared me to think like I haven't seen this movie in 40 like
Yeah.
40 years 40 years. That's insane. I kind of loved it. I
Oh,
you know
cool. I'm
I
gonna
you know
rewatch it.
it's I love what's his name, David Keith, who's the dad, and Drew Barrymore's great in it, and Art Carney, and it's got a really, and Martin Sheen, it's got a really good cast. And that I've been listening to all day, that Tangerine Dream score is so good.
That's awesome. I was going to rewatch it right before this too, but I didn't get into it. I went for it because I've always had a fear of clowns. But welcome, Sean. How are you?
John.
Hey, I'm doing this on my phone because we're having internet issues, but I hope you can see me and hear me.
Yes. Yes, thank you so much for being here. I was talking to
Okay,
Bill
good.
about his early exposure to Stephen King. Was Stephen King an early favorite for you?
Oh God, yeah. Both the books and the movies. My very first like grown-up book that I ever read was Salem's Lot. My aunt gave it to me when I was 12, and she gave it to me with the caveat, "I'm going to give you this. I hope this doesn't scare you." And I'm like, "Yeah, I'll be fine." It scared the shit out of me, and I slept with a popsicle sticks crucifix under my pillow for like 2 weeks.
Oh my God, that's so funny.
And then a couple of years later, they made Silver Bullet, which is based on the Stephen King novella Cycle of the Werewolf. And that for a long time was my favorite Stephen King movie, even though the werewolf design at the end is terrible. Apparently, there was an issue between Dino De Laurentiis and the director, and they could never come up with a firm design for the werewolf. So when you watch the movie, the werewolf looks different in different scenes.
Yeah.
And then when you do the final reveal, he looks like a giant teddy bear. So, but that's my earliest Stephen King memories. So.
Gotcha. Yeah, I know. We all kind of started reading him
Don't know
early.
about
I would
for
say
you.
like
Yeah.
middle schoolish type of thing. But Silver Bullet was completely new to me on your recommendation. I had never seen the movie. Bill, had you seen it?
No, I'm kind of like blown away that I'd
Yeah.
somehow never watched, either I'd never watched it or I saw it so long ago that I don't even remember, like, one of those things maybe I encountered when I was super young, but I think I would have remembered it because I would have loved it as
Oh
a
my
kid.
God, yes,
And I loved it. I
absolutely.
loved it watching it now, but I would have especially loved it as a kid, I think. And yeah, it was great. I had a lot of fun with it, and Gary, I like Gary Busey in that era, and as a kid, I liked Corey Haim so much, so I thought it was
Yeah,
terrific.
and Megan Follows right around the time she
Oh
was
yeah.
doing like Anne of Green Gables
Yeah,
and
that's what
stuff, so it was.
I was watching it, and that's my wife walked in, and she had somehow, she's the same age as me. She kind of grew up on this stuff, had never seen it either. And she was like, "Oh, Anne of Green Gables." Yeah, it was terrific. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah, was that an early favorite for you,
Yeah,
Sean?
Gary Busey's great in that.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was my favorite. When I was a kid, we had a VHS store, a rental store, and it was in a guy's garage. So when you went to rent videos there, they were like $2.50 for a video rental, and he had a soda machine that had soda and beer in it, and you never knew what you were gonna get when you put money in it. And he didn't care what you got. So we would go there and, you get lucky, you get a beer, you split with your buddies, and then we'd go to the house and watch, Silver Bullet or Carrie or something like that. So, but Silver Bullet, I same reason, same thing that Bill said. I liked Corey Haim as a kid. I love Gary Busey. I love the sort of whimsical yet terrifying sort of atmosphere in the movie. It feels like somebody's telling you a story around a fire, campfire, and I really like that.
Yeah, I think he does nostalgia so well, like,
Yeah.
and just turns it on its head. Like he manages to capture what it's like in childhood, how, things seem like possibilities, and then there's darkness lurking. I mean, a lot of people do that. Of course, David Lynch does that, but this is different. I feel like there's more sweetness and more nostalgia in these.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. And King has a really great talent for tapping into what is both childhood fears and adult fears.
Yeah.
And the idea that children can handle fear better than adults because their minds are still elastic. They're not rigid in what they believe and don't believe. In Silver Bullet, I know we're talking about other movies, but in Silver Bullet, you really see that Corey Haim's character, not only because he saw the werewolf, but because he's a kid and he accepted there's monsters. And it takes everybody around him a long time to really finally believe it. And, of course, it's in many cases it's too late. So there's definitely this idea of the sort of imagination that exists in children that's also sort of a secret power for kids.
Yeah, I saw that yesterday with It. I watched the 2017 version. I had never seen the movie before. And I think because I was always scared, my grandma had these like clown statues and they were all over her basement and they just scared the hell out of me growing up. And so as much as I love Tim Curry and I want to see the miniseries, I just kind of avoided that in the book. But that was interesting and it kind of reminded me of Stand By Me operates the same way, Silver Bullet, these sort of stories of childhood. And I also really liked that it's a disabled character who isn't like an other or the sickly kind of the scary thing, like in Pet Sematary, gets a little overboard, that kind of thing. But I really liked that, you know, he's just a kid and he's trying. Big Ed, this was around the time of Twin Peaks, so that was interesting too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. He's so good in it. That's Big Ed.
Yeah. Yeah. And then so Pet Sematary would be next, like chronologically. I'd never seen that one either. I remember I got the book for like my birthday and it just kind of sat on my shelf. I was like, I don't want to read about pets dying. I was so scared of that. So I would go and read like his dramas, like Dolores, Claiborne and stuff, which were probably more disturbing. Although Stephen King did say that's the one book that really scared the hell out of him. Yeah.
Yeah, that's the book.
Oh, go
Oh, go
ahead.
ahead, Bill.
Oh, you go ahead, man. Sorry.
I was just gonna say I've read everything he's ever written, and you know that's the one he said it. You know, not just because he's a father, but because it's the idea of the emotional heft in that book is he would do that. He said, I would do that to bring my son back. And so this idea of how far will you go into the darkness is really strong. And also the book itself has the most terrifying ending. It builds up to this really almost classic, you know, EC Comics, Tales from the Crypt ending. The movie, not quite so much. I like the movie. I do think, like you said, the representation of like the disabled sister in it is a little bit overboard. I think Dale Midkiff, who stars as the dad in the movie, is really good. I think he's carrying a lot of
Yeah.
the weight. Of course, Fred Gwynne as the neighbor sort of
Yes.
become an iconic a horror character. I think the ending of the movie leaves a lot to be desired, but up to that point, it has a lot of great scares, and it doesn't seem to, for me, have the tone of a Stephen King book. It feels more like a generic horror movie. There are some flashes of that, but I think overall it's a decent movie. I think the ending is a little lacking, but that cat in there is scary as hell.
Oh my gosh, it sure is. One thing I noticed too watching it was there was this mini series around the time called Elvis and Me, which was the Priscilla based on the memoir, and it had Dale Midkiff in it and he had that accent going. And this was shot like right after that and he's still kind of rocking the Elvis head tilts and the so it was a little like I was joking, the closest we're gonna get to Elvis in a Stephen King, the King in a King movie. Yeah, so I had fun with that. And then this was one that Stephen King adapted himself for Mary Lambert, who'd only or was most famous for like the Madonna videos and stuff. So really cool that we had a female director helming Pet Sematary at the time. But yeah, so the ending is better. What did you think of the movie, Bill?
Yeah, I mean, I chose it to talk about because mostly because of Fred Gwynne. I think
Yes.
that's one of the great performances in any Stephen King movie. I think he's just so perfect for it. Just, and I tend to like those older characters. I was saying I rewatched Firestarter last night, like Art Carney and Firestarter and Richard Farnsworth and Misery. Like I like those characters in his world. So to me, yeah, the premise is especially as a dad is this kind of terrifying and really haunting premise. But Fred Gwynne is just perfect in that movie, and I think that's really what draws me to it. And I think it's a really good movie and a good adaptation. And I think the movies, you know, that I've, as I said, I've rewatched a bunch of stuff recently, and the movies that kind of try to strip themselves down a little bit, and kind of just barrel along tend to be the ones that work the best, as opposed to
Yeah.
the ones that try to leap all over the place and do what he does with interiority and flashbacks. And, you know, it's a very difficult thing to pull off, I think, in a movie. It's, you know, one of the things you can do in fiction that it's much harder to do on film. So, I like how kind of stripped down and straight ahead Pet Sematary is for the most part, despite those flashbacks that, you know, are kind of probably the weakest thing about the movie.
talking about stripped down and, a couple characters and not dealing with too much. That's maybe why Misery works as well as it
Oh, yeah.
does. It has that old-fashioned feel of like, this could be an Agatha Christie or something like, you love Richard Farnsworth. Harry Dean Stanton kind of has a role like that in the Christine movie as well. And I guess when he wrote Misery, people were like, "Do you hate your fans?" And he said he was writing Annie, based on his addiction, like that she was the embodiment of his addiction the time. And I had not heard that. So when I read that recently, I thought, wow, that's fascinating. Misery, of course, is a towering film, one of Kathy Bates' best performances, James Caan. But yeah, there's Richard Farnsworth. I love him in that.
Oh, he's so good. And Francis Sternhagen, who I love, who's also in I remember, I've never seen it again, but there was I can't remember if it was a TV show or a miniseries when I was younger called Golden Years that was a Stephen King. She was in that she was so good in. I think it was a show that got canceled, or maybe it was a miniseries. I can't remember.
It was a mini series, and it starred Keith Sacherbeck and
That's right.
Francis Sternhagen. And basically, it was a mini series about an older gentleman, an elder gentleman he's a janitor at a scientific research factory. He gets hit with a chemical or something another, and he starts aging backwards. He starts getting younger,
That's right.
and so then it becomes there's a division of the government, a fake division of the government in the Stephen King world called the Shop, which is basically like the nefarious scientific research department, and they start chasing the character from Golden Years, which it got canceled. I think it wasn't going to be a series, and it didn't go more than a couple of weeks. I think maybe a month. I think it was an idea he had. It's not based on a book. It was based on an original idea. But again, I think it's very hard, like Bill said, to do the interiority of King and sort of get that same sort of very, like I said, he's got this sort of, he's like a combination of Ray Bradbury and Robert Bloch. He's kind of the both of them. And that little bit of whimsy is hard to do in movies. Speaking about Misery, I think Misery is probably the best Stephen King adaptation.
I
Maybe other
agree.
than Carrie, I think Carrie's close, but Stephen, I mean, Misery, if you've read the book, there's a lot of extraneous stuff that like Bill said, they were able to cut out and just get to the heart of the story. And of course, it's Kathy Bates' performance. She won the Oscar. But I think James Caan gives a very understated, underrated performance. James Caan was known as a tough guy, as a quote unquote, stereotypical quote unquote man's man. And playing Paul Sheldon, he's very vulnerable, not just physically, because he is physically, in the movie, he's been disabled or temporarily disabled, but also in an emotional aspect. He's vulnerable because Paul Sheldon is a writer who feels trapped by his character. And I know quite a few writers who have mentioned that or spoken about that, especially series writers, where you kind of get trapped in one genre and one lane, and you're not allowed. And having been a writer now for a published writer for almost a half a decade, more than a little bit over half a decade, I definitely can relate to the idea of wanting to expand your horizons, to wanting to do something different, but as like a lot of people say, you got to dance who brought you to the party. And so sometimes as an author, as an artist, you do want to try something new. And I felt a lot of that in Khan's performance, talking about Paul Sheldon, talking about not wanting to write about Misery anymore, and sort of the anger that he has, that he's not allowed to be the full artist that he wants to be, the full writer that he wants to be. And so for me, that's also a really understated, underrated aspect of the film that I really love.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think that's a really good observation. Something I've been hearing a lot, working at Poison Pen from visiting writers, is that publishers keep telling them that their next book, we want the same but different. And so that's kind of what they have to keep doing. And yeah, like we have some who've written the same series like for decades, like 30, 40 books and stuff, and they do get tired of them. And sometimes they'll put the character away for a while and then return. But yeah, I don't know how you guys do that. I think it is a really interesting. I also like it just from a writing standpoint. Like, she gives him the paper and he's just like, okay, this is what I do at home. And so he just sits and writes. It's amazing to me.
It's also a really funny movie. I mean, I think, just it gets King's humor really really effectively, which is not always the case. I mean, you can see it in a lot of other adaptations where it's like, misfires on that so badly, or tries to get that and misses somehow. But yeah, it's so stripped down, and just I feel like you get the backstory in that movie just through James Caan's performance, through Kathy Bates's performance. Like, you don't have to go into all of that in any other way, which is such a incredible thing about it, how straight ahead it is.
Yeah, one thing that Bill and I were talking about, because we watched a bunch of movies beyond the ones we were going to for this because we got so into it, is you really start to see his patterns and the things that he loves to do. And of course, there's always the writers. So as writers, what do you think the appeal is? Like, you're putting yourself in your book, or what do you think of all of his stories about writers?
I think he's doing something that a lot of artists do. Songwriters sometimes will write songs about performers. One of my favorite songs is Hollywood Nights by Bob Seger, and he's talking about a kid who becomes a music star and goes to LA and falls into the undertow of LA. I think King is doing that with his writers. You have Paul Sheldon, you have Thad Beaumont from The Dark Half, which I know that wasn't one of the ones we picked, but The Dark Half, I think, is an extrapolation of that idea of not being free to be who you really want to be. And I think you could translate that to any walk of life, but especially an artist, especially a writer. And, The Dark Half movie, I think, is really good. It's
I
different
like
than the
that.
book. Yeah, I think it's Timothy Bottoms. No, it's
Timothy Hutton.
Timothy Hutton, yeah.
Who's Timothy Hutton? Thank you. Timothy Hutton, who plays both the writer Thad Beaumont and his creation George Stark, he has such a great time. You can tell he's having a good time playing, essentially an evil twin, which is different in the book, because in the book he's not really a twin in his physical form. He's a spiritual twin. But anyway, that movie really does tap into, again, the idea of being trapped by your success. And I'll be a little vulnerable here. I've wanted to talk about writing different types of things, maybe some outside of crime genre, maybe something horror, maybe some sci-fi. And you do have those conversations, and my publishers are great. I'm not complaining, but you do have those conversations like, well, let's do that next time. Let's kind of keep the train going. And so you can feel a little stifled as a writer, and you can feel trapped. You can feel like you're in the gilded cage, which is a line that's mentioned in the book and the movie, The Dark Half. But I love The Dark Half just on a pure. It's the closest King has written come to writing a true noir crime novel, even though it's a supernatural story, because George Stark is just a wonderfully evil noir villain. My favorite line in that book and in the movie as well, he's in an apartment house, and George Stark is trying to kill someone, and he's chasing him down the hall, and somebody opens their apartment door, and they're like, "What the hell's going on out here?" And he looks over at him, he's like, "Murder. Do you want some?" And the guy closes the door immediately. So,
I just rewatched The Dark Half. I really liked The Dark Half, and it's weird. And I also obviously I watched Secret Window, and it's weird how much Secret Window is kind of a riff on The Dark Half
Yeah,
and The
that's a really
Shining
good
a
point.
little bit. I mean, he's just always kind of drawn back to the same themes, types of characters, and he's kind of digging into this, the investigating the same obsessions throughout his career. And I love that. I mean, I love that for sure.
Well, this era, we really, I know it's not one of the ones we were going to talk about, but you can't not really talk about one of the most famous adaptations, which is the Shawshank Redemption, kind of that era. And then they tried to repeat the same magic. They had the Green Mile, which doesn't work as well. But what did you guys think of those films?
Oh, I mean, the Shawshank, love. I loved it when it came out. I
Yeah,
still
it's a
love it.
masterpiece, I think,
I have
but
not really revisited The Green
no.
Mile. I remember vaguely kind of reading those books when they were kind of whatever they were serialized, sort of in those little small, kind of whatever. I think they were published as one at some point, but I was getting them as they came out in those little novella type things. I really don't remember much about the movie. I think I was in a place where I kind of couldn't take Tom Hanks at that moment.
Yeah.
There was a lot of stuff that was working against that movie for me at the time. So I've not revisited it since then, but I love
Yeah.
Shawshank Redemption, obviously. You know, when you talk about the best King adaptations, it's either, you know, Misery, Shawshank Redemption, Stand By Me, The Shining. You know, I mean, there's that top tier that you can't get away from for sure.
Yeah, The
Yeah,
Shining is
I totally
hard.
agree.
I was just going to say The Shining's hard because I think that's a masterpiece, but for me, that's Kubrick.
Yeah,
And
it's
then,
not. Yeah, King hates it, obviously, and
yeah. But
whatever. But
Sean, you were going
it's a great movie, and it's based on the book, so sort
Yeah.
of.
I think Shawshank Redemption is probably one of the finest American movies ever made.
Yeah.
I really do. I think, you know, and you've got the performances in there. You know, Tim Robbins, you know, Morgan Freeman, oh gosh, not William Sanderson, you've got all these great people, James Whitmore, you know, you've got just such a staggering amount of talent, but at the end of the day, it's still a human story. It's still a horror story, you know, it's horror,
Yeah.
it's in prison, terrible things happen, but it's the most incredibly optimistic film I think I've ever seen. I watch it every year at Christmas. I love the Shawshank Redemption. I think if the last 15 minutes, I will put the last 15 minutes of the Shawshank Redemption up against the last 15 minutes of any film ever made.
Oh, wow.
It's so beautiful. The warden getting his just desserts. You know, Tim Robbins going to the bank and getting his money in his nice new suit that he had wrapped up in plastic. When he walks out, how he leaves the old shoes and he takes the new shoes. And then you got
Yes.
Morgan Freeman doing the sort of, it's almost like a detective story. He's doing the wrap up like a Columbo story. He's like, who looks at a man's shoes? And he climbed through that, you know, he crawled through, you know, 7 miles, you know, stuff I can't even imagine. And then as he's talking, you see Tim Robbins come out of the drainage hole. It's one, you know, that beautiful scene with the rain coming down and, you know,
Oh,
literally and
yes.
metaphorically baptizing him.
Yep.
He's a new creature. You know, he's you know, he there's peace in his heart now. He's no longer, you know, Andy Dufresne. He's a new man, a new person. And of course, you know, you've got the great scene at the end where Red finally makes it, which is different than the book. And I think it's better. The one time I think the ending is better in the movie, because in the book or the novella, it ends at that wall. He gets the black rock and he digs in there and finds the lunchbox. And then he's, you know, talking about going to Zenitahatu, and that's it. It ends. But I love that you see Andy Dufresne waiting for his friend, you know, and it's a beautiful story about friendship and familial and agape love. And I think it's like I said, it's so funny because I know it's a King adaptation, but it feels more like a Frank Darabont film, but it's still
Yes.
beautiful. You know, and I've read the original, which is Rita Hayworth in the Shawshank Redemption.
Yes.
And I just love, you know,
That
I love
story
everything
is
about that
amazing.
film. The scene where he rips the poster down, and just all of the reveals and everything is just so good. I think everybody in that movie deserved an Oscar. So.
Yeah, I think it's brilliant. Stephen King is one of those people where sometimes his short stories, I think, are actually far more impactful. And he said famously, like, the only thing wrong with the Shawshank Redemption adaptation is the title, and that's my fault. So, because he's like, you know what, I should change that title. But I mean, it's not at least as long as Rita Hayworth and the Shawshank Redemption, but yeah. Yes. I remember seeing Green Mile when it came out, I think maybe once on DVD, and same thing. The acting was very good, but it didn't have the same magic. It felt like they were kind of returning to that same thing. Yeah.
I thought the Green Mile, it feels like a movie where everybody's trying really hard,
Yes.
but they're trying too hard in a way.
I agree with you. Yeah, it doesn't, I mean, nothing about the Shawshank Redemption would you say is effortless, but it feels more natural, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're not really pushing to get that reaction. It's just sort of like there. And
And
I
as a
think that's
writer,
different.
to me, it's sort of heavy-handed. John Coffey, his initials are JC. Obviously, he's a Jesus Christ symbol, and it's just so over the top with all the wannabe symbolism and everything. I don't hate it, but it's a movie where I don't feel any need to ever watch it again.
Yeah. I was glad you guys chose Secret Window because it's one of those, like we talked about The Mist a little bit before you got here, that I think people missed. Yeah, like it came out, it was here for 5 minutes, and then everyone forgot. But I do tend to watch Secret Window probably more often than some of the other ones. I think it's a great Johnny Depp performance. I think I'm a big fan of David Koepp. And I love what they layer in at what time. I was watching it with my mom who had seen it before, but for whatever reason, she completely forgot about the big reveal at the end. She's like, where's this guy? And I was dying. It was kind of like watching the No Way Out or something with someone who doesn't know. But, did you guys like Secret Window right away or did you kind of warm up to it? Bill, what did you think?
This one was Sean's choice because I'd never seen it. Somehow I was one of those people that had missed it
Yeah.
somehow.
What did you think?
I was kind of mixed on it. And I'm
Yeah.
kind of mixed on David Koepp in general. I because I just watched The Dark Half, I think,
Oh, gotcha. So it's felt a little, yeah.
it felt like such a riff on the same material almost. And I like what The Dark Half does much better than what Secret Window does, because there's kind of nothing I like less than it was him all along kind of twist, the
Yeah.
fact that the Turo character is not real, and he's also like the George Stark character in The Dark Half, he's from Mississippi. So there are things I really liked about it, and I was enjoying it for probably, the first half. I was really enjoying it, and then it started to kind of lose me a little bit in the second half, and then by the end it had almost lost me totally, I think. But that being said, I had a fun time, with it, for sure.
Yeah, what did you think of
Yeah.
that one?
I liked it. I was one of the people that saw it when it first came out. I thought it was excellent. It comes from the Stephen King Four Past Midnight collection, which is four novellas. Of the four, it's probably the weakest story, but I thought they did a good job with the movie. Although I will say, as a Southerner, I don't know what Stephen King got against Southerners, because George Stark is supposed to be from Georgia and crazy, and then John Turturro's character is supposed to be from Mississippi and crazy. So we're not all crazy, south of D.C. But that
Well, he
being
makes
said,
in the
I think it's a
movie he's in the movie he's in the Dark Half, he's from Oxford, Mississippi. I don't know what
Okay.
in the
That's
book they
right. In
did.
the movie, he is. In the book, he's from Georgia. Yeah. But, it's so funny because I think Johnny Depp gives a really good performance. He's trying really hard. But like Bill said, that last reveal, it is that, oh, it was him all along. And I think Depp does do a good job he does a good job in the scenes of the reveal, but the reveal itself is kind of weak. But up to that point, him and John Turturro are just chewing up the scenery, and I like
Yeah.
seeing two really good actors kind of go at it. I love that. I think it's, as far as the adaptations, it's funny. It's probably pretty faithful to the book, because I remember reading the novella. But like I said, the novella itself wasn't super strong. There are other books. That whole collection is probably some of his weakest novellas, because that's also got The Langoliers, which was a TV movie about 20 years ago,
Yeah.
which has a really weak sort of reveal. And I sound like I'm crapping on Stephen King. I'm not. I'm just, these stories that have the best, strongest reveal. There's a story in that collection called The Sundog, which actually is probably the strongest story by the Polaroid camera, which I thought was pretty cool. But going back to the movie, I think that was in the beginning. I think that was the sort of the beginning of the end of Johnny Depp actually acting and not
Yeah.
just being Johnny Depp. Not just being a bunch of ticks and motions and I got Googling and stuff. And so it's one of his last, like, actually I'm he's actually acting. He's really trying. I don't think the material is strong enough to carry the movie, but like, it's also a fun movie to watch. It's sort of a good bad movie. And I mean, there's a lot worse Stephen King adaptations out there, so I will say that.
Yeah, exactly. I was going to ask you, you mentioned the TV movies. I think Salem's Lot, the late 70s one, is just masterful. I love that television movie. It's one of our film critics here in Arizona's favorite. Bill Goodykoontz is always, every Halloween is like, watch that, you guys. And I agree. What are some of your thoughts on the TV adaptations? Are there any you think everyone should check out?
I just watched that for the first time, actually, because, I guess because it came out in 79,
Yeah.
like I didn't see it when it was on. And I read that book when I was 14 or 15, but I didn't somehow never saw that. And I love Tobe Hooper. So I watched that just recently and really, really liked it. I also really like, this is not TV, but I also really liked Tobe Hooper's adaptation of The Mangler, which is insane.
Okay.
Which is based on, great. I think it's in different, is it in Night Shift, I think, that story.
Nice shift. Yeah.
It was, the It miniseries was huge for me as a kid. That really, it wasn't my introduction. I think I'd been reading him already at that point, but I kind of lived and died by that miniseries as a kid. I haven't revisited it in a long time. I've been meaning to. I will say, of recent stuff, I just watched for the first time Lisey's Story, which I think is great, which
Okay,
is
I haven't seen that.
Pablo Larraín. Came out in 2021, and it was on app. It's on Apple TV, and I guess I missed it right when it came out because I probably didn't have Apple TV at that point, but I do now. So I watched that last week and was pretty blown away by it. I love that. I'd rank that definitely up there as one of the best
Oh, wow.
TV
Okay.
things of his I've seen. And it's like an eight episode limited series, and it actually does a lot of the stuff that other things try to do with the interiority and the flashbacks and the different worlds and stuff. And you can see I recently watched Dreamcatcher for the first time too, which is an off the rails, just kind of insane fucking, just I can't believe it's real, like the whole thing. I need an oral history of that movie. And I know he wrote that book apparently after his accident when he was kind of doped up.
it.
But Lisey's Story kind of does some similar things in a much better way. And it also has a main character who is a writer, so definitely recommend that one. Love that one.
I have a Salem's Lot story. I didn't see the original broadcast in 79, but in around 83, 84, they replayed it on a local, our local channel, and they replayed it like it's like a week long. It was like a
Yeah.
week long miniseries. They replayed it on a local channel, and I think I was maybe, I think I just read the book, so I'm maybe 13. And watching it as a kid, it's terrifying. David Soul is really good. The Marston House, it looks just like it's described in the book. The production values on that are amazing. I know King was a little bothered that they made the vampire the more Max Schreck Nosferatu vampire, as opposed, I thought James Mason was great as his
Yeah.
familiar, his daytime familiar. The scene with the kids walking through the woods, which is terrifying in the book, is terrifying in the movie. I thought that did a good job. As an adult, I'll tell you, there's another scene in the movie that's real, in the TV movie that's good, when Fred Willard's character is chased out the house. He's having an affair with somebody's wife, and he's
Yeah.
chased out the house, and the vampire's like waiting for him there. And they do those old school hard cuts on the TV movie, and I like that. I love the superimposed vampire teeth on the moon at the end of the TV show. I've seen it recently, as I watched it recently in anticipation of this. I think it holds up fairly well. I think if it's a product of its time, and if you look at it from the special effects aspect and everything of that time, it's a really faithful adaptation. I think it's probably, Salem's Lot has been adapted a few times. There's with a recent TV movie. There was a TV miniseries a few years ago with Rob Lowe. I think Salem's Lot is probably the one people want to redo the most because it's vampires. It's
Yeah.
seems simple, but there's again that sort of whimsical, I don't want to say whimsical, but that small town sort of existentialism that exists in his stories that a lot of the TV movies or adaptations don't get. The original 1979 version gets it. Everybody in town knows everybody. So when they become vampires, you see a person who's now a vampire, you're not afraid of them because you know them all your life. You're not afraid to let them in the house and so on and so forth. So I really like that. Also, There's a TV version of The Langoliers, which is awful. It is just terrible. Bronson Pinchot is in there. He just sweats for like 6 hours. He's high on coke for the whole movie. And to Bill's point, Dreamcatcher is, it's not even like it's a the worst movie. It's insane movie. It doesn't make any
Insane.
logical sense. It's like poor Morgan Freeman's eyebrows are in business for themselves. There's like there's no rhyme or reason to what the monsters can and cannot do. There's a scene with a guy sitting on a toilet. He's trying to keep a monster in the toilet. He drops a toothpick and he bends over and like it's like one of the dumbest character movements in a movie I've ever seen. It's all over the place. I mean, Tom Sizemore's in it and he's supposed to be the hero. It's just, like Bill said, I would love to talk to people who worked on that set. Was everybody on cocaine? Like, was everybody high? Like,
Yeah, and it's written by, I mean, the script is by William Goldman and it's directed by Lawrence Kasdan and it's got an incredible cast as Freeman and Timothy Oliphant, Jason Lee, and what's his name? Damian Lewis. And I mean, it's just,
yeah.
it's nuts. It is absolutely nuts. And, I
Poor
don't
Mark
know.
Wahlberg is in it, and
Oh,
Mark
Donnie,
Wahlberg is not Wahlberg, is it
Donnie
Daniel? No,
Wahlberg.
it's Mark. Donnie
No,
Wahlberg. Donnie
Donnie, yeah.
Wahlberg plays a special, a specially challenged individual who gives them magic powers. And then I'm gonna ruin it for people who haven't seen it. So anybody who haven't seen it, I'm gonna ruin it for you. He plays a kid who's their friend. There's these four guys, and they have a friend. His name is Duddits, and he's a kid. He's a specially challenged kid, and of course they've got the Stephen King psycho insane bullies. Like every bully in a Stephen King movie is a sociopath. It's a young Hannibal Lecter, and so these bullies are beating up Duddits, and these four guys come and save him. And because they save him, he literally gives them magic. They all have a magic ability. At the end of the movie, Duddits shows up. And I love how he comes in the door. And I think they were aiming for it to be emotional and powerful, and it's just funny as hell. Because he comes in like, "Hello, Mr. Gray." And I'm like, "What the fuck is happening? What is going on?" And then he turns into an alien. That's the end of the movie.
Oh
He turns into an alien.
my God.
I
Actually
mean,
need to see this now. And there's
I mean,
no
it is.
explanation.
I'm kind of obsessed with it. I mean, it is just insane. And I'd never watched it because I guess I'd heard bad things until recently.
I need to see this. Oh
Is.
my God.
Yeah, definitely need like a full length oral history project on the making of that. I guess the book and
If
the movie.
anyone remembers making that movie,
Yeah.
please reach out to us because I want to talk to y'all. Like, what was happening? Was everybody on mushrooms? Like, what?
It is bonkers. I will say one more thing about Salem's Lot, about the 79 Salem's Lot. I noticed on Letterboxd our friend Travis Woods in his review, he says, this is what he says, the rare King adaptation that understands how important the 75% soap opera, 25% horror ratio is to making his best work as successful as it is. And I think that's something that
Yeah,
totally
he.
true about
Yeah.
that movie.
Yeah, exactly. That is kind of a Stephen King element. The one that we didn't mention, I'm going to ask you guys for any we didn't mention that you want to recommend for me would be The Dead Zone. I had not seen that until a few years ago with Christopher Walken, Brooke Adams. That is a really good one. It's Cronenberg. I thought that was very well done. It's high quality. It's kind of that era of scary movies that are like a little bit classier. So I do recommend that. What do you guys think for other ones you want people to check out?
Well, I love that one and I love Christine. I
Yeah.
would say, I'm a big fan of Lewis Teague and I like Cujo a lot.
Okay.
That's an underrated one that I just rewatched recently. Lisey's Story is definitely a big one that I think maybe some people missed.
Yeah, I want to see that.
I know people, I don't know how like super King fans feel about Mike Flanagan, because Mike Flanagan's become obviously one of the most prolific King adapters in recent years. And I like his Doctor Sleep a lot, and I like mostly like Gerald's Game. I haven't seen the new one that I think, you know, people seem pretty mixed on The Life of Chuck, but I'm generally a fan of his, and I think he what we were just talking about with Salem's Lot, I think he gets that ratio right. He's somebody who knows how to do that. And definitely, like, you know, as far as first time watches, other than Lisi's story in this recent batch, The Mangler kind of blew me away. That was a lot of fun. And we had talked about Dolores Claiborne. I'm a
Yes, that
huge,
was
huge
really well done.
yeah, and I'm a huge Jennifer Jason Leigh fan, and Kathy Bates is obviously brilliant. So that's a
David
difficult
Strathairn,
yeah, that's a difficult one for a lot of the reasons that some of his work can be very difficult to talk about. But it's a really good movie and great book.
How about you, Sean?
I don't know if anybody should, I don't know if you missed it, but At Pupil is a great Stephen King adaptation,
Okay, with Renfro, yeah.
with Brad Renfro. And is it Ian McKellen?
Yes.
No. Yeah, Ian McKellen. I think it's a really good adaptation of a really, really dark book, novella from different seasons. Brad Renfro, you know, the late Brad Renfro gives an incredible performance. Ian McKellen is terrifying. It's very creepy. It feels like almost like a psychic vampire story of these two really disturbed people feeding off each other. It's one of those movies that it's like Secret when it came out and it kind of went away, but I don't think it's a bad movie. I think the subject matter, you know, for anybody who hasn't seen it, At Pupil is about a young kid who discovers that his neighbor is a Nazi who's hiding out, and he basically blackmails him into telling him about Nazi Germany. And it becomes this very dark, twisted story. I thought it was well done. Another one that's a bad adaptation, but I think it's funny and unintentionally funny, is the Tommyknockers on an ABC miniseries with Jimmy Smits and Meg. Gosh, I can't think of her name. The young lady that was on CSI. Meg.
Was it Meg Tilly?
Anyway, Jimmy Smits is in it. No, I can't think of her
Oh,
name
that's okay.
now. Oh gosh, but anyway. Jimmy Smits is one of the stars, and it's the book that Stephen King says he has no idea, he doesn't remember writing it at all, and
Yeah,
it's
there was an
insane. It's so
intervention right
bad, but
after
it's so
that.
funny. So yeah, if you want to watch a, excuse me, you want to watch a bad movie and get a kick out of it, watch Tommyknockers. But if you want to see a really dark, sort of twisted, yeah, that's really good, check out After the Tommyknockers.
After the Tommyknockers? Okay. Gotcha. All right. And I know
Yeah.
we didn't mention Carrie, of course, because that's been very
Yeah.
well covered and The Shining has been well covered. But I like that you guys inspired me to watch some of these that I'd never seen before, like Pet Sematary and Silver Bullet. So I really appreciate that. And I love talking to you guys about anything, but this was especially good. So thank
Yeah,
you so
it's fun.
much.
Thank you so much, Jen. It was great talking to you guys.
Yeah, you have a good
Thank
one.
you, guys. Great talking to you too. Good seeing y'all. All right,
Bye.
bye-bye.
I also want to thank everyone for listening, especially my patrons who support the show and help fund my research equipment, film rentals, RSS fees, and more for as little as $1 per month at the Film Intuition Patreon, which is the home base for the show. Other ways you can support the podcast are by sharing, reviewing, and subscribing to Watch with Jen wherever you get your podcasts, and also checking out the cool merch store hosted and created by our talented logo designer, Kate Gabrielle. You can find the merchandise store, including shirts, tote bags, stickers, and more, by visiting filmintuition.com and clicking on the shop link. The show's theme music is Solo Acoustic Guitar by Jason Shaw and is available in the free music archive. Well, until next time, please take care and happy movie watching.
This is Jen Johans at filmintuition.com and filmintuition on social media and Letterboxd. And this is Watch with Jen.